You know what today is?
December 8th. It's a holy day on the Catholic calendar. Is that what we're going for?
It's episode 26.
Oh yay! That's the one. The other one that I didn't think of. Yay!
That marks half a year of podcasting.
Mm-hmm.
So, congratulations. Where's my gift?
Your gift is that I bought myself a new microphone. So that you will hopefully have to do less editing when you listen to me. Now, if you feel like also buying yourself the same gift for me, then that would be great. When the two occasions that I edit the podcast.
I'm not sure you understand quite how my post-production neuroses works. When the other person's not talking, just seeing that flat line there, I want to delete it. So, I'm gonna cut out the silence no matter what.
Oh no, that's fine. But then sometimes there are those things that aren't silence that are just the little spikes from you like hitting the table or touching the microphone to adjust the boom or taking a sip of water.
I cut all that out too.
I know. I had to do that too.
Twice. Just twice.
I know. Only two times, and yet I'm complaining so much. I'm such a diva.
It's almost like you don't do this nearly as often as I do.
Yeah.
I mean, like, for work-related things.
Well, that's why you hire consultants, Dan. They come in, and they tell you the things that people at the company are used to. That's what consultants can really bring to the table.
So then what would you say you do here?
I bring the podcast to the people.
You take it from the engineers to the customers?
No, I put it in the FTP, and then they download it with their podcaster apps.
That's it's a very valuable part of the workflow.
Mm-hmm.
How was your Monday?
It was Monday-licious.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How was your Monday?
I did not order a Doritos pizza.
Well, of course you can't because they're only available in Australia.
Oh, is that what the deal was? I couldn't see past my rage long enough to see where it was available.
It said, I think that was the first sentence.
Well, I just looked at the picture and I saw the word Doritos pizza and I just lost it.
Oh yeah, your vision blurred immediately. You were full of rage, slamming things down on the table, throwing your computer across the room.
And did I understand that the premise is essentially they are going to mash up Doritos chips and sort of like stick them to the crust? Is that basically what it was?
Yes, I think they make a Doritos powder or crumble and then adhere it to the crust of the pizza.
Wait, so that's basically just like the flavoring that they put on the chips, but instead of on the chips, they're putting it on crust.
No, I think they also use the chips as part of the crumbling material.
Ugh.
Crunch factor.
So it's like a Doritos creme brulee for your pizza crust.
Delish.
The reason we had to delay the recording about a half hour is because I had to order a pizza for dinner.
Oh, I trust you did not order the thing I just mentioned. It was only available in Australia, so what did you order?
No, but it did come from Pizza Hut.
Oh, Dan, why, Dan?
Because there are two places that deliver pizza to my house, Pizza Hut and Domino's.
Dan.
Yeah.
You live in the same city as Pizzeria Bianco.
You mean that place that always has an hour and a half wait and is a 40-minute drive?
Dan?
Mm-hmm?
Nothing's really worth your health, you know, sitting at home and eating Pizza Hut or Domino's. Just go get the delivery, well, pickup from Pizzeria Bianco.
No, that's not going to happen.
Jason went there tonight because he's there on a business trip.
That's right, you told me.
Yeah. Fortunately, the two of you are not going to run into each other, so that'll be fine.
No, probably not, because, people need to deliver food to my house, because I'm not going to put on, like, pants and go outside.
Another reason no one's ever going to come to visit you.
It's all right. I mean, I got a dog, and my girlfriend lives here, so that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hi, we did go out this weekend. We bought a Christmas tree.
Oh, that's exciting. I wish I had a Christmas tree. I did that 2 years out of the nine that I've lived here, nine and a half I've lived here.
So festive.
Yeah, well, it's a pain in the butt. Cause
it is.
I live on the second floor of an apartment building, so I got to take it up and down the stairs, and then there's just needles everywhere when you go to take this thing out. which is not a tremendous amount of fun to deal with, because I feel somewhat obligated to sweep them from the communal stairway, even though technically it's not really my house, but I feel like it's kind of rude to just leave a bunch of pine needles just hanging out in the stairwell. So then I'm just there sweeping by myself.
Well, before you bring it in, you gotta make sure you shake it off. Not gonna pick that one up, are you?
No, I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole.
We did discover that our vacuum cleaner is apparently non-functional. I mean, it always gave the appearance of sucking up dust and dirt, but it doesn't work on pine needles. So
mm-hmm. So I guess it just sucks.
Yeah, but who knows how long it's just been giving the appearance of collecting dirt and just leaving it in the carpet.
That's a comforting thought.
Very much so, yeah.
Just think of all the spider eggs and scorpion eggs and human hair follicles.
In the Christmas tree, a little ladybug fell out on the floor.
Well, that's not so bad. Ladybugs are kind of cute. Like, if a scorpion fell out of your Christmas tree, I would just burn it.
Fall out of the air vents in the ceiling.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Comfy stuff. So shall we move on to our follow-up?
Sure.
What is our follow-up?
Where should we start? Should we start with your podcast betrayal?
What was my podcast Oh, when I was on The Incomparable.
Not only were you on The Incomparable, but you did a show about a movie that we've already talked about here.
Yeah, but we plugged the show that we already talked about here on that. So I feel like it compensates for my appearance. And also, I told you I was going to be on the show. So it's not like it was a surprise. Like, oh, how dare you? I was like, I'm going to go do this thing. And then you're like, okay, fine, whatever.
And then, you didn't really ask me. You're just more like, hey, I'm going to go do this. How dare you?
I didn't realize I needed your approval, Dan.
Well, I mean, I'm just trying to play up the drama for the podcast. But sure, yeah, of course. How could you?
You were deeply hurt.
It was the deepest betrayal I could imagine.
Okay, so anyway,
it was a good episode and as long as it doesn't get more downloads than our version, we'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kidding. It was wonderful.
Okay. I was almost mostly happy about my introductory line, so if everyone wants to stop listening at about 1 minute in, then that's fine.
I thought you did quite well with that, actually.
Yeah, I had planned that. I didn't tell anybody this, but I had planned it ahead of time, like several hours beforehand. I was like, oh man, they usually have like a quote thing, like everybody says like some sort of a quote. What will I say when I get on there? I was like, what would be the most perfect thing for me to say? And so I was thinking of all the quotes from the movie, because obviously I have them all memorized. And then it was the Guy Fliegman quote when they're inside of that bay there, and then he says, you know, he's just happy to be on the show. And then I went and I looked it up on IMDb to make sure I had the wording exactly correct. And I watched, I think, 3 clips of it on YouTube to confirm. Yes. Just to make sure I was going to read it back correctly. Cause I wanted to get the intonation right too. And then, so I was on the episode and I was extremely nervous, cause my introduction consisted of basically like, here's Joe. And it was just like, hi, people that don't follow me on Twitter or know who I am, except for Jason Snell. And so then we did the episode, and it was a lot of tense fun, but very interesting, and I like it. I think our episode probably covers more of the material of the episode, but I think there was a really unique twist that Erica brought to it when she was on, because we talked more about Gwen than when you and I had talked about it. So I think it's really worth a listen to if you liked our episode of Galaxy Quest. Listeners, I'm addressing you. Pay attention.
Don't snap at them.
I'll snap at them if I want to.
How rude.
Thanks.
No, it was a good episode, and I definitely think it wasn't just neither of us sort of like rehashed the same stuff. So they work independently of each other. If you want to listen to both,
yes, complimentary. Yes,
I gotta ask: did you have backup quotes in case somebody ahead of you said the one that you were gonna say?
No.
Oh,
yeah,
you are out there on a tightrope, my friend.
Yeah, I was really playing, you know, really riding the edge of it, and I was really happy that absolutely no one quoted the movie in any other way before they got to me, and I was just like, oh well, that's a real relief there. I'm set.
Just with each person who went by and didn't use your quote, you were just secretly just pumping your fist under the desk, weren't you?
Yes, well, I was trying not to do that because my Yeti microphone would have picked that up probably.
Well, I mean, just because you rested on the desk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, moving on to the next item of follow-up.
So we got some feedback about the episode one teaser from our friend Paul Emerson on Twitter, and he happened to mention that back in 1998, one of his coworkers decided to download the trailer and host it on his employer's internal network, and ended up bringing the entire server down because the file was either too large or they were watching it too many times, which is just a fantastic story.
It's comical when you think about what the file must have been.
He said he thinks that employee was fired for doing so.
Mm-hmm.
Which maybe if it wasn't episode one, that wouldn't be quite as sad/funny.
Mm-hmm. Everything about episode one is sad/funny.
We should get Sarah Koenig to find out where that man is today.
Oh boy. So
moving on. You know, I wrote Terminator Genesis trailer down here in the document.
I don't know why.
I've already forgotten most of the trailer because. Go ahead. Do you have anything to say on the matter?
Yes, I do. Next topic.
Well, the trailer for Terminator Genesis is out, and it's a thing. So go watch it.
Or don't.
Sure. Or don't. Going way back, we have Ryan Reynolds confirmed as Deadpool.
Oh yeah, longtime listeners might remember our coverage of the leaked CG Deadpool footage from Blur, and
that's Blur Studios for people who don't speak lingo.
Oh yes, who are not down with the sickness, as it were. the episode of with our Deadpool commentary, in which we said, you know, we're fine with Ryan Reynolds, but it was sort of creepy with the CG, which is a statement that also comes up, I guess, again in another Ryan Reynolds movie. Moving on to the next topic,
we're just bringing things up and not really commenting on them and just moving past it. That's fine. That's I'm not sure that's how we're really supposed to do follow up. But that's
well,
fine.
Well, what was your other commentary on Ryan Reynolds as a Deadpool?
Well, to be honest, I'm shocked that they picked him for it. It's not just like, well, we already built the model and it's kind of shaped like him, so I guess we got to go with him. But I mean, hasn't he proven that he doesn't have the ability to be a leading character in a movie like this?
Well, no, I mean, he was Deadpool in Wolverine, X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Yes, but spoilers, he died, so who cares?
I don't know. People? About things? It doesn't matter. It's Ryan Reynolds. He's in one of my all-time favorite movies, which is a Christmas-themed movie, which I hope we will get to this Christmas season, which is Just Friends. But Ryan Reynolds is in my personal opinion, was not my favorite first choice for the role of Green Lantern, but I'm sure he's probably going to be fine in his, you know, bunch of one-liners Deadpool role, just like he was in the little Blur clip where I didn't really object to anything he said. It was just sort of the weirdness of the CG.
I objected a little bit to some of the things he said, but I like Ryan Reynolds too, don't get me wrong. I think he sort of fits more the degenerate character that, like from Waiting than anything else, but I guess if we're going to give him a nice big $100 million tentpole VFX film, sure, why not? We'll see how that goes.
Dan, don't be a jerk. Why are you jelly?
I'm not. Moving on. Mm-hmm. Speaking of announcements from visual effects studios.
Oh, is that... Is this
that's our segue into the Sony disaster.
Okay. I wasn't sure if that was...
Stick with me, Joe.
Don't snap at me. All right, so listeners, you may be familiar from our episode with Interstellar, where I briefly mentioned that Sony was hacked the week of Thanksgiving, and we did not know at the time the extent of the hack or any other information. Nothing was really released. There was just a scary skeleton photo, and we weren't sure basically what to say about it at all, other than it affected Sony Pictures Entertainment. And to my knowledge at the time, it would have only affected potentially main lot things or whatever, and so maybe it wouldn't have been that bad. And then we come to find out the week following, after we recorded our episode on trailers, basically immediately after that, that the Sony hack was far more severe than we initially thought, anyone initially thought. They had released 47,000 social security numbers for employees, along with home addresses, other personal information, birthdays, everything you'd need to basically impersonate and steal the identity of anyone who had ever worked for Sony Pictures Imageworks, because it was also former employees as well as current employees. We also learned that the situation, apparently the hackers had claimed to take 11 terabytes. We don't know if this number is technically accurate because they haven't released all of that information, but at this point, it seems very likely because they've been doing dumps in the order of 100 gigabytes a day. So that's also there. Things like marketing plans have been coming out, things like financial projections, things like research into the viability of certain stars for certain roles in certain markets, research into the viability of the Angry Birds movie. Different kinds of things have been surfacing. And I am very against the hack at all, period. I don't think it was good. I think that it really screws over former employees. I think it really screws over everybody. I don't see the silver lining to this of maybe some information coming out to be worth the potential financial risk of every other employee. I think that's just messed up. And as for the perpetrators, there have been rumors about who it was. Initially, it was believed to be somebody who had certain inside information into how the company worked, either a very recent former employee or somebody who was currently working there on the way out. But we don't have any confirmation of that either one way or the other. And also, there are certain things where it seems that potentially, in certain statements released by the hackers, that it has something to do with the movie The Interview, which is a movie in which James Franco and Seth Rogen assassinate Kim Jong-un of North Korea, which they had objected to for a very long time. And so apparently that comedy movie may have triggered an insult which may have triggered the hack, supposedly. There are security experts reporting there's a certain number of similarities between this and other attacks that have happened in banks and other institutions in South Korea, and that potentially this is what ties it to North Korea. North Korea has officially denied any involvement in this, but it's sort of one of those things where it's like, I don't know why anyone would say any of this stuff about North Korea at all unless it had something to do with that, because if you were just some hacker or something, why would you be so hung up on The Interview? I don't know. But anyway, so that's the situation. This past weekend, Saturday Night Live, James Franco and Seth Rogen had a funny little bit in the opening monologue for James Franco, who was the host. And I did not personally find it very hilarious, but other people probably could have, in which they joked about other things that were revealed inside of the hack, with scantily clad pictures of the two of them together, and so that was also, I guess, a thing. But that's basically it. Is there continues to be a lot of information being released about this major motion picture studio. I don't know if it's worth, Dan, do you think, mentioning how the studio is structured or anything? I don't know where to go with this.
Yeah, it's like I said to you when we were talking about it offline. I find it hard to believe that all of this effort was simply over the distaste for this movie, The Interview. I mean, I'm wondering where these connections to North Korea came from. We know that one of the first things that was leaked was both of their pay rates, Seth Rogen and James Franco, for this movie. I assume there were other things that made them think that this had something to do with North Korea, other than the fact that they were releasing and talking about things related to a movie that sort of takes place in North Korea that, again, nobody has seen. So we don't know that they actually assassinate Kim Jong-un, or they... I mean, I just assume that's the plot, and then antics ensue, and then something dumb happens. But, like, it's not like this movie is out there, and it is actively insulting them. I mean, I assume the premise would be insulting to them in general, but all of this on the speculation that the movie is going to be so insulting that it should start some sort of war, that's kind of far-fetched for me, but... That's apparently the situation, according to these news outlets at the moment.
Yeah, well, like I said, it bears, according to security firms, it bears a resemblance to the break-ins at certain financial institutions in South Korea by North Korean operatives. And it also has the very strong message specifically about this movie, which is referred to as a terrorist act. Which, while I might not be a big fan of James Franco and Seth Rogen movies, I would never really think of them as a terrorist act. But there you go. That's what it is.
The thing about it is, what do they stand to gain by making this movie not come out? Even if they were to, they were able to blackmail the studio into actually not releasing the film, which seems to be their intent. What do they win? A studio loses like $60 million? Like, is that their end game? If they were in fact so angry about this movie that it would potentially incite an international incident, wouldn't they be okay with the movie coming out because United States, you're going to have to deal with the repercussions of that? Or would they maybe have that message sent to the State Department or something? Like, I don't understand what the hackers in this instance stand to gain by either preventing this movie from coming out or releasing information that was hacked from a studio. There doesn't seem to be anything there other than just the identity information. Like, I mean, is this just sort of a big dog and pony show cover for the fact that they have a bunch of people's identity and they're going to try and steal all of their money?
No, I don't think that's going to happen at all. I think this is probably tied specifically to the ego of maybe a dictator of a certain country. If we were to assume that it is North Korea, I don't think they actually want a war, but they have threatened many, 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 many times to go to war and to do nuclear tests and do all kinds of other childish, weird things that don't seem rational to us. But that's just because they don't need to seem rational to us. They need to seem irrational so that we're potentially afraid of what they would do. But I have no idea. I don't know if North Korea is really the one behind this or not, or as North Korea alludes to in their official statement, sympathizers with North Korea, which I find more ludicrous than any other possible situation. Just somebody...
The fact that somebody sympathizes with North Korea?
Yeah, the fact that somebody out of their own heart is just like, oh, those poor guys in North Korea, that poor Kim Jong-un, that poor guy. I mean, I don't see that happening. I definitely see financial ties, like a motive, like hackers being paid to do this. But, well, you know, we're not going to know for some time. So I don't want to continue conjecture along those lines. We'll see where it goes.
The thing about it is, like, this is not the first time somebody has made a parody or a joke out of North Korea, specifically Kim Jong-il or Kim Jong-un. So why this movie? Why now? Why this method? None of it makes sense to me. So I'm still just watching it like you are to see what happens. But in the meantime, the people who are genuinely affected by it, you included, I guess basically you just try and batten down the hatches on your identity and your financial security and hope that they're just full of themselves and they're not actually going to do anything with that data.
Yeah.
Okay. Or the terrible people who are reading these dumps on the internet aren't going to do anything with it.
That's really the important part, is I don't think that the perpetrators of this are actually going to commit anything with the information. They're not going to, I do not think that they will do anything with the information, but I think that putting the information out there is really what they want to do. They want to increase maximum damage by giving it to everyone. To that end, like you said, people who used to work for Sony or currently working for Sony are mostly affected by this. And it affects the, the workers more than it affects the executives. If you think about it in a certain way, because basically all of their credit and history and stuff is on the line, especially if you are a former worker, because you are not currently in the loop for any of the company memos on the issues that are happening at the company. And I can attest to this because I am not in the loop for any information. Another former employee had contacted Sony and forwarded to me an address for them, for me to contact Sony. And I did so. And the only statement that I could get from Sony on this after I contacted them is that they would put me on a list for All Clear ID Theft Protection Services to contact me. And that in the meantime, it's a good idea for me to change all my passwords and check my credit reports at the three major credit bureaus. And then they provided a domain to go check that. This is the only contact I've had as an employee of Sony from 2005 until 2014. This is my sole source of information, and I had to solicit the information from them. If anyone is listening to this and they used to be an employee of Sony, you can contact them at SPE_people_organization@SPE.Sony.com. Listeners who are not employees of Sony, please do not contact them. That is not helpful. For instance, I got this email at 12 noon on a Sunday, so obviously they're working overtime to respond, which is appreciated, but the fact that no proactive effort is being taken on the company's part is a little strange, especially in light of the PR blitzes for the next James Bond movie that occurred last week, which is curious, because if you think if you could organize a PR blitz about this and a company holiday party, that you could email the people that used to work for your company, but that is not a judgment. That is just a theoretical.
Maybe they lost the Excel file with everyone's email address. They should ask the hackers to find that for them.
Well, see, that's the thing. With this hacked information, apparently the malware that was installed on the computers at Sony also wiped everything. So they theoretically could be in a situation where they might not have all of the information they used to have, which might include some file that had former employee addresses. So I'm not going to be too harsh on them for that, but that is just an observation from someone from the outside that no effort has been made to reach out to former employees. You have to be proactive about contacting them and getting the information. I've also seen reports that people who work outside of the U.S. now, because of the shifting change in visual effects, which is one component of Sony Pictures Imageworks, that those people that don't have U.S. addresses are having trouble freezing their credit if they're worried about possible credit problems, because they might not have a U.S. credit address, a U.S. permanent address for freezing their credit. So that is also a consideration. It's definitely not something I would wait on. If you are a former Sony employee listening to this, I would move quickly on it and find out all the information you need to find out, and contact the people at Sony, people in organization, as soon as possible.
Yep. And the last thing I'll say on this, and we'll move on, is it'll be interesting to see how Sony actually reacts moving forward, aside from the sort of communications blackout while they try and sort out what exactly happened. You know, we got word, what was it today, that there was a couple independent security firms investigating to see how this happened, or, you know, the nature of it. And they said it was a massive, unprecedented hack, which other people are refuting, saying, no, you guys should have been prepared for this. But
we don't. Just to be perfectly clear, the only people who said it was an unprecedented hack that Sony could not avoid is the security company that Sony hired to actually audit their systems right now. So no one else has said that other than the security company they hired.
Right. And the thing is, we want to know, like, what is Sony actually going to do going forward? Presumably, they're going to patch whatever hole was used to get in, but is this going to stir some sort of, you know, corporate-wide change that is actually going to be useful? Or are we just going to expect that Sony is going to brush this under the rug now and hope it doesn't happen with their fingers crossed again later?
So, let's talk about the movie.
Let's cheer ourselves up with
with a childhood classic
movie.
Yes. Can you sing that again? Can we loop that? That was good. Can we auto-tune it?
No.
Okay.
I don't think I have an auto-tune thingy.
Oh. Okay. I see how it is.
Does your audio editing suite have an auto-tune thingy?
It might. And by it might, I mean I honestly don't know. So shall we move on?
Sure. This week's festive December Christmas-related movie is, of course, Home Alone, which I'm sure you all know based on the title and tweets and everything else that we've done since recording this.
Yes. Home Alone. Kevin McAllister, played
1990.
Yes. Played by whom?
Macaulay Culkin.
Macaulay Culkin? I'm not familiar with this work.
he didn't do a lot.
No, he didn't. I think my favorite role he's ever been in is Saved. Which is saying a lot, I think.
Wasn't Mandy Moore in that?
Yes. Yes, she was.
I saw that movie. I don't remember it, really.
It was good. I would recommend it for potentially a future episode. But anyway, Macaulay Culkin. This is the start of his career, and apparently the start of his crazy parents being super crazy. So, poor guy. But Macaulay Culkin is the child actor who's in this role in a John Hughes movie where his home is going to be broken into by some robbers. And he is going to have to defend himself. More importantly than that, he makes a wish that he will be by himself without his family around, and that he won't have to deal with any of them anymore because they're so mean and awful and terrible to him. A wish he comes to regret towards the end of the film, naturally. If you are anyone who is watching this and is surprised by the twists and turns of this plot, you must not be able to anticipate or think for long durations of time, potentially 5 seconds or more, because it's everything in this movie is forecasted well in advance of it actually happening. But despite all that, it is a Christmas classic. And I think a wonderful, delightful holiday film.
Yeah, you say a John Hughes movie written by him, but directed by Chris Columbus.
Yes. If anyone remembers Chris Columbus, he was the guy that ruined the first two Harry Potter movies. No, but more seriously, he directed Hook, which is also something that people have strong feelings about. So you may not be super down with Hook and Bangarang, but But that is also a Christopher Columbus movie.
Also, Home Alone 2, Mrs. Doubtfire,
mm-hmm.
Bicentennial Man.
I personally love Mrs. Doubtfire, and I love Home Alone 2, and I like Home Alone 2 better than I like the first Home Alone. But you can't really talk about Home Alone 2 without talking about the first Home Alone, which is why we're doing the first one.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of backstory you got to get through before you get to Home Alone 2. In the first one, he was left home alone, mm-hmm. and bad things happened, but he outsmarted the bad guys.
Yes, and in the second one, he is home alone in New York, because he's in New York. But it is formulaic and based entirely on the plot of the first film, so you really do need to watch this one in order for any of those callbacks to make any kind of sense. But shall we start?
Yeah. As is my tendency with my terrible memory, I forgot that Joe Pesci did that. Like in the beginning, he was the fake police officer walking from house to house asking if people were going to be safe this Christmas, which I thought was a weird thing to do.
Wait. You're skipping way far ahead.
That's literally the beginning.
No. The beginning is the title sequence.
You want to talk about the absurdly long title animation of the little blue house on the black background?
I love the absurdly long title sequence of the little blue house on the black background with the score by John Williams, which is fantastic and is highlighted several times to this film. As many listeners of films that John Williams have scored have known, John Williams likes to do this little thing called leitmotif, where he does the same little piece over and over and over again. And so the theme to Home Alone is in Home Alone like 50,000 times and played slightly differently in different scenes to get different effects.
That's that, whatever it is.
No. It's the
man, that new microphone is really paying off big time right now.
I know. It's really capturing my vocals. So, oral experience. moving on. So the whole thing with this opening is it's great, and you don't see title sequences like this anymore. And a lot of people would say, oh, this is boring. Don't put this in. Just start right in on the action. Let's get going. But I think this sets it up pretty nicely because it has a sort of whimsy to it. But it is also very clearly very 1990s, specifically 1990. But
yeah, I'm not going to lie. I thought it was like the New Line Cinema logo and it was just really slow. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. It's the house and that's the logo. Oh, right. I forgot.
It's cute. I like it. And then we go on to the Joe Pesci scene. And I also forgot that Joe Pesci was in this opening scene when I went back to watch it the other day.
Which is honestly a really funny scene of him trying to get everyone's attention in a very 1990s John Hughes kind of way. But, like, of things to do to find out if people are leaving town, like, maybe don't do that where they all know your face now?
Yeah. Well, especially if you don't have a gold tooth that has a giant lens flare that shoots off of it every time you open your mouth.
It's just, you know, if my house gets robbed around Christmas time and the police are asking me, like, did you see anything suspicious in the days up before you were leaving? I'd be like, you know, now that I think about it, a police officer did show up at my house for no reason. Which, if you contrast with the actual police officer who knocks on the door for like 3 minutes and goes, nobody's here, is a little out of place.
Yeah. But I don't think
apparently in Chicago, cops don't care about people.
Yeah, but I don't think these upper-class white people really were putting a lot of thought into it.
They're just dumb rich white people, is that what it is?
Basically. I mean, this movie is an exercise in white privilege, if we really get down to it. Because
we made it all the way to Paris, and we forgot one of our 13 kids.
Yes. And not only that, they flew first class. They
Just the parents.
Yeah, but they had airport shuttles come just for them. They had the whole experience of getting back to Chicago, where they paid for all of that too. They have a giant, enormous house, which was in most respects modern for the time period that this movie was shot in, with the exception of the furnace being utterly ridiculous. But they're pretty well off. Let's be honest.
Worth pointing out, though, that Uncle Frank was kind of a cheapskate in that he was trying to steal things from first class on the airplane.
Yeah, well, Uncle Frank is not part of the immediate family.
Uncle Frank is a
Yes, Uncle Frank. Well, okay, well, I guess you got to bleep that one. But
well, first of all, if my brother-in-law or whatever, if he yelled at my kid, "Look what you did, you little jerk," I would have punched him in the face.
Yeah. Uncle Frank is not a sympathetic character, which is a good thing because I'm happy we don't see him in the end of the movie when everyone comes back to be happy again.
Well, he probably stayed in Paris because he's a selfish little jerk.
Yeah, well, I'm glad of it. I mean, did you really want him to come back and be like, "Oh, I'm sorry," because that wouldn't have felt heartfelt. Although, One thing I was reminded of this time when I was watching it with Jason, and I were watching it because it's a favorite film of his, and he had also not, for some reason, not seen it in a couple years, and we were both commenting on the fact that we don't really actually know who any of the other children are in the film. There's so many of them, but they're not really like clearly defined. We know who Buzz is, of course.
Yeah, we know Buzz.
Yeah,
for sure.
But then, like, everyone else is just a little hazy.
Yeah, and what's Kieran's name in this one?
That's Fuller.
Fuller.
But he has a larger part in the second movie.
Oh, does he?
Yes.
I don't remember.
Well, of course. But then Kieran goes on to play in the most magnificent movie, which is Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Yes, Kieran in Scott Pilgrim plays the delightful character of Wallace, who is probably the best part of that movie. But, but Buzz's IMDb photo is actually staring me in the face right now, and I have to put this in the Skype so you can see it. Have you taken a look at him lately?
No, I don't want to. Why do you do this to me? I don't want to be mean.
You do.
I don't want to be mean.
Scope him out. He's got such awesome facial hair.
I don't want to be mean, Dan. I'm a nice guy.
Just not to me.
Oh, he kind of looks like John Candy.
A little bit.
It's kind of sad.
Maybe when they do a remake in a little bit, he can be the Polka King of wherever they were Polka Kings.
Yeah, I thought that was so funny. This is one of the things where I loved this movie a lot when I was a kid, and I would watch it like constantly on VHS. And there was like a Pizza Hut like ad in the beginning of the VHS tape every time I would put it in.
Of course there was.
Of course there was. And so... Well, also in front of the Ninja Turtles VHS tape. But I would watch this.
You got to get into that pizza vertical early.
Yes, the pizza vertical. Are we stealing too much from Upgrade FM? But anyway, so we would...
They don't get all the verticals.
We can take the horizontals. So I don't know. Diagonals? Catty corners.
Queen to Rook 6. I don't know how chess works.
Rook 6? Who's Brook?
Rook. I said Rook. What?
Oh, okay.
Are you worse at chess than I am?
I don't know. Am I?
I don't know. Are you aware that there's a game called chess that has something called a rook in it?
Are you qualified to tell me if I'm worse?
No.
Okay.
Are we qualified to do anything that we do on this show?
No, we're not. Everyone ignore all of our follow-up and the thing we said about Sony. So, moving on to the rest of the film, we get introduced to Buzz in the beginning of the film as a giant jerk in this pizza scene because he has eaten all of the cheese pizza somehow really quickly. I don't know how that happened.
Yeah, a lot of things in this movie happen on a very short time scale. Yeah, I think we talk about it in most of the movies we talk about. But this whole movie, again, takes place in like 3 days.
Yeah, and so he eats the cheese pizza, all of it, and then like does his little like fake vomit thing because he's going to spit it back up for Kevin to eat. And then Kevin throws his little temper tantrum where he attacks Buzz.
Little tiny Macaulay Culkin, like, football tackles Buzz, who apparently Kevin has a future in football because he really takes him out, knocks over the milk, and then the Coke gets spilled by the dad, which then Kevin gets blamed for somehow.
I think it's called acting, Dan.
Well, it's just, you know, everyone is mad at Kevin, and he's ruined everything, even though it was the dad who kind of did half of it.
Yeah, also, it is not Coke, it is Pepsi, Dan. If you've watched this movie, there's one thing you should take away from it, and that is Pepsi. Pepsi and dairy products. He gets sent up to his room without anything, and we are, of course...
Which is like, at least send the kid with a slice of pizza when you're going to banish him to the attic, right?
But he only wants cheese. And
well, okay. So when do kids get to decide whether or not they eat dinner?
Like I said, white privilege, Dan. So this is what happens, Dan. This kid is raised in this family that's rich, and he gets to order his cheese pizza, and he gets to have his cheese pizza, and when he doesn't get to have his cheese pizza, he gets to throw his little temper tantrum. And so
you're saying
happens.
The ultimate victorious character in this movie is Buzz, where he said a few days in the real world for Kevin would do him wonders, in which he is actually proven right.
Yes. Yes, this is a movie for Buzz's... prognostication. I have no idea. We get a scene, of course, with Catherine O'Hara, and I think she is a fantastic actress. I love her. She does a very good job of being the mom in this film, in which she is playing it in a way that doesn't make you hate the mom.
I kind of hate her.
No, she's got to enforce certain things. She loves her kid, but she can't let him just, like, run amok. And so she's not, like, a complete mess. In the in the beginning of the movie, she is obviously, of course, like, I guess you would say, like, meaner than she is at the end of the movie. But she does care about her kid. And I credit a large part of that to her performance, because some of the lines are unflattering. But there's you know, the whole thing where she tells him to go upstairs and he says, oh, well, I hope I never see you guys again. Like, I just want to be by myself and for all of you to go away. And she's like, well, I hope you really don't mean that. And she seems hurt by it in that scene. And so you can see that and you'd be like, aw, poor Catherine O'Hara. She just wants her kids to love her and to be normal and to not cause a mess when he can't have cheese pizza.
She doesn't really do a whole lot to help him kind of grow. She's just like, well, you shouldn't say that. Now go lock yourself in the attic. But anyway.
What's she going to do?
I was just hoping she would do something akin to what people refer to as parenting.
Dan. Okay, so anyway, this whole thing goes on. And then we get our sort of vaguely cosmic moment here where the winds are going and everything's kind of crazy, and then all of a sudden the tree falls on the power line, and then that's what sets this whole thing in motion of them being in such an urgent rush that they can't check to see if their child is there, and that they just do a basic head count and the neighbor's kid gets counted, even though he's obnoxious, and he leaves, and then the family all leaves to go to the airport, and they have the whole running through the airport scene in O'Hare, and then they get on the plane, and then they go, and she's like, oh, I think we're forgetting something. And then we cut back to Macaulay Culkin waking up in his bed upstairs and being like, oh, and, you know, going downstairs, where is everybody? And he finally realizes he's all by himself, and he's like, yeah, and he eats ice cream. A lot of ice cream. So much ice cream. There's so much dairy in this movie. I feel... I'm concerned about the lack of green vegetables, to be perfectly honest.
This movie is just a shill for big dairy, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Cheese pizza, ice cream, macaroni and cheese. I mean, where's the nutrition?
Doesn't he even call out Stouffer's by name with the mac and cheese?
Yes, because it's the frozen Stouffer's mac and cheese.
Looks delicious. I'm still not entirely certain why he thought he needed a fork and a knife to eat it, though.
I don't know, but he didn't get to eat it, so...
Which is ridiculous, because on the microwave it says 8:57 while he's making it, so you think he would know, maybe I should eat this quickly because I got 3 minutes before the bad guys said they were going to show up.
Yeah, but he had
which, by the way, they're very punctual bad guys.
Yes. Well, I mean, they might have been a little early, you don't know. You know, he had to light the candles and stuff, and then he had to blow out the candles. But so anyway, skipping it back to where we were in the film.
Yeah, when he wakes up alone, in the kitchen at least, I was surprised how clean and unlived in the house looked. It was like, everything was so tidy and in order. It's almost like people weren't sprinting and rushing around to get out of the house.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when everything's in
magical John Hughes land.
Yeah. I mean, this movie's not a realistic movie. And so there's a certain level of magic to everything that happens. The area there in the kitchen is clean. It is so 80s looking with the wallpaper and the tiles and everything. It's kind of funny in the laundry chute. But he finally realizes he's there by himself, and he gets to watch the movie that Uncle Frank said he couldn't watch.
Yeah, Angels with Filthy Souls, which I did not remember.
I love the name of that. A
delightful James Cagney ripoff.
Yeah. Jason asked me if it was real, and I was like, no, of course it's not real. It was just for this movie.
Well, the real movie is called Angels with Dirty Faces, but it's close.
Yeah. But he watches the thing, and he gets scared. But this comes up several times later on in the movie, and in, of course, the sequel, where he gets to do this little VCR trick of playing back the audio from this.
He's more accurate with that VCR controller than anyone in the history of VCR usage has been, which is great.
Yeah, I mean, he must have like a jog wheel on it or something, because I don't know how he can be so specific. But anyway, he watches that and gets, you know, scared by the whole experience of watching that. You know, he goes to the laundry room. He gets scared of the furnace in that little scene, and he goes back up. And then we got the whole thing of him trying to like figure out his little routine in his life, which involves him going to the grocery store. I'm sorry, the drugstore to buy a toothbrush that is approved by the American Dental Association.
Well, you can't forget his post-shower narrating scene, which I thought was odd, which naturally everyone will remember from when he slaps on the aftershave and does his face. But like, why was he narrating his activities, describing how thoroughly he had washed himself? I thought that was really out of place.
Maybe John Hughes was a big Bret Easton Ellis fan and had read American Psycho. I don't know. But which I doubt. But yeah, it was an odd scene. I think it was about like what an adult he was and how he was the adult master of this house, even though he's just a small child coming from Abe.
Right, because he actually says, I shouldn't be afraid and hiding under the bed. I am the man of the house. It's like, really? Because you're eight, so no.
Well, also, it might have helped if Macaulay Culkin's acting was even in the slightest bit convincing, but it's not.
First time out the gate, you can give him some credit.
Yeah, poor kid. So he goes on and does this whole thing where he goes to the drugstore and he's going to buy a toothbrush, and he wants to know if it's approved by the American Dental Association, which is a big deal, and he runs into the...
How is he even aware of the American Dental Association?
I don't know. It's just one of those like things that's supposed to be like, oh, he's so precocious. But whatever. So he gets scared because he sees the snow shoveling guy who we saw briefly from the vantage point of Buzz's broom at the beginning of the movie, which we didn't comment on here, but it's obviously a nothing scene. That guy is supposedly killed his family and like lives by himself and like keeps dead bodies in the barrel full of salt. And we are quickly introduced to the fact that this old man does not talk immediately whenever you see him, which is why Kevin can always run away in absolute terror rather than
he does have a very intense stare.
Yes. And he's a sort of like a lip gumming thing. It's very strange. Like he just moves his mouth around a little bit. And it's just like, you could just talk. You could say like, hi.
Maybe he has dentures and he doesn't have them in those first few instances. So he just kind of like clamps down and makes that awkward face.
Yeah. Or it's just a total contrivance. But the whole thing, like he gets scared and he runs away and he's shoplifting and goes across the, you know, pond where everyone's skating and the police chase after him and stuff, which gives us a little action scene. And then
with the very inept police officer who just kind of gives up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would give up too. It's not worth it. It's a freaking toothbrush. But at the end of all of this, he's so shocked that he stole something. He's not paying attention to a van that is pulling out of a house. And that van, of course, contains, guess who?
Is it the Wet Bandits?
It could be the Wet Bandits. And they might be having an argument about whether or not they are the Wet Bandits, because Marv might feel like he has a little shtick that he likes to do. And Harry, played by Joe Pesci, might be slightly ashamed of this little shtick that Marv likes to do. And this is, of course, the lovely exchange that they're having, and which distracts them from driving, which is why they almost hit Kevin, and then they stop, and then Harry leans out and yells at the kid, and his gold tooth glints brightly in the sunlight, which is, of course, the little clue to us and to Kevin that, oh, this might be the same cop from before, which causes a whole thing of Kevin trying to slowly kind of run away, but not run away. And then
the scene where he's walking down the street and being very slowly followed by two grown men in a van, which isn't at all suspicious.
I love that scene because they both start whistling in the van.
Like looking around like, no, we weren't following you.
Yeah, it's like, this is so inconspicuous.
I would have stuck my head out the van and be like, what are you doing, kid? You're walking in the middle of the road after we just almost ran you over.
Yeah, it was dumb. And, you know, he runs away and he goes to the church and stuff, which sets up the church for a later scene, but does nothing for the immediate scene we're in. And Kevin realizes that they're going to potentially go to the house and cause problems and stuff, and he's going to defend against them.
I do like, just for a moment to back up, that when they're robbing the house, they're basically, they're stealing things in like the black Santa suits. They're sacks. They're just like dumping all of the things into just a big sack that they carry over their shoulder and walking around. Like that's a good way to take things that are potentially valuable and breakable.
I thought those were just the contractor garbage bags that you can buy at Home Depot.
No, one of them, it looked like a laundry bag. It had like a drawstring around it and it was black.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but that's also why Harry says to Marv, you know, you're the world's greatest cat burglar or whatever, when he's like using a golf club to like wipe out all of the like ornaments and tchotchkes inside of a cabinet. Because he's so not subtle about it. And this sets up the whole thing. Sorry. In the basement scene earlier, there had been mannequins, and it was unexplained, but they were there. And then these mannequins get used later on to be people.
There was another one in the parents' bedroom that was wearing some sort of nightgown. I'm not sure if somebody was like sewing it or working on it, but the mom apparently had a nightgown on a mannequin in the bedroom.
Yes, apparently all this family's money comes from mannequin nightgowns. I don't know how it works.
In any of the movies, do we get any hint as to what the McAllisters do?
No, they
they're just rich and white.
They're just rich and white and live in the Midwest. So potentially, I don't know, union fraud. I have no idea. So
I was going to say the steel or auto industries.
Yeah, same thing.
The union delegate, isn't that the appropriate answer for Goodfellas?
Yes. Union delegate. So they do their thing. He sets up his little like decoy party, which I find rather unconvincing in this day and age, but I thought was rather ingenious when I was a child.
Oh, absolutely. I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever seen, with Michael Jordan moving around on the train tracks.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to have one of these like fake parties with myself, probably because I was an only child, and that would be the only way I would do something like that.
Yes, fake parties with myself. So the thing here is, of course, he's also very good, apparently, at cleaning up after himself, because after all of his shenanigans, every time he does one of these shenanigans, the house is seemingly clean again, which is impressive, I think. Because if I was a kid doing all of this, it would just be like a bomb went off. But
well, he doesn't clean up Buzz's room.
Well, yeah, but Buzz is a jerk. So
is it worth mentioning that, like, in the alternate real world reality of this movie, like when he falls off of Buzz's bookcase and like gets buried underneath all that stuff, he probably would have like given himself a concussion and knocked himself out and had just been unconscious for 3 days.
Probably. I mean, but like we said, this movie has a certain magical realism to it, being a John Hughes movie. And so the whole thing unfolds where the family finally, you know, of course, figures out that Kevin is by himself. And the mom's going to go back, but she can't quite go back. So the family is, you know, in a hotel room. I'm sorry, at their, I guess, Uncle Rob's place in Paris, hanging out. And the mom is just going to wait at the airport for a standby flight. And things are really kind of crazy for her. She does the whole, like, negotiating with that strange old couple about how she's going to give them, like, all kinds of stuff if she can go back right away.
Oh man, airlines, am I right? Yeah. Like negotiating with the ticket agent, that's a scene that's never been done before.
Yeah. Well, the fact that she gets anything out of it leads you to believe this was a 1990s movie and not a 2014 movie, but the whole thing unfolds and she goes off on her little thing over to America, only to be shuffled around further at different American airports.
I did take a little issue with Buzz when they're over at their uncle's place, saying, "Don't worry, we live on the most boring street in the United States. Nothing dangerous will happen." I would like to challenge. I don't know how Awatuki would battle against wherever in Chicago they were from, but I would contest that our street is more boring than theirs.
I don't really think that was the point of his statement.
I think it was partly related to the point of his statement.
I don't really think he meant the point of his statement to really be literally that. I think it was an assurance just a general assurance about the safety of his neighborhood.
In this movie where Buzz is supposedly accurate about all of his predictions, I want to make sure that we're vetting the things that he says.
Buzz vetting.
Also, I found it very peculiar that it's only been 2 days, and for some reason, Kevin is doing laundry.
Well, oh, yeah. Jason commented on that, too, when we were watching it. He's like, why is he buying detergent and fabric softener for, like, only... Because when he goes to the grocery store scene later, he's like, why is he doing that? Like, he's only been there 2 days. Like, why does he need to do laundry?
Yeah, at the end, he says he bought milk, eggs, and fabric softener. Like, those are his three items. And we actually see him doing laundry on day two for... I don't know why. I mean, it's not like he's just doing his clothes. I mean, okay, you're going to do the whole family's laundry. That's how very kind of you.
Well, I mean, maybe he got ice cream all over his clothes from his escapades with ice cream. But I do like the scene with the grocery store clerk. She is quite curious about what he's doing for the holidays and why he's shopping by himself and why he's buying all of these things. For $19 for all that he's getting, which I told Jason, you know, at a Whole Foods today would probably be $60. but it was very amusing to watch all this unfold. And she's not letting him get away with anything. But he's you know, coming back with something for every little thing that she has. Like, oh, do you think I'd really be in here shopping by myself? Like, my mom's in the car. It puts her off guard enough that she lets him get out of there. This is kind of entertaining to me, because at this point, if I was him, I would be terrified and I would have called the police. Like, there is no amount of, like, being alone for yourself for a day that is entertaining that would continue on to the second day if somebody had chased you in a van and you were just shopping by yourself, and you were potentially worried about them coming back again to do something to you. It's not good stuff.
But yeah, let's just put this on the table right now. The moment he saw the bandits in the van and he was scared, he would have called the cops, and then that would have been the end of the movie, because none of this would have happened.
Yeah, and it's not like he doesn't know how to call the cops, because later in the movie, he calls the cops.
Oh, wait, but the phone lines are still down because of the thing from earlier where that one guy knocks on the airport shuttle and goes, you know, the lines are going to be down for a couple days.
No, but the lines weren't down because by that point, because he was able to make a call out from the house.
Uh-huh. And I like that he even referred to the phone company as Ma Bell.
Yes.
It's pretty great.
But it was just stupid. Because, okay, because after all of this, he has a scene with the old man in the church, and they're talking, and, you know, they come to the realization that the old man, you know, is not terrifying, surprise, and he has a family, surprise, and they're not dead, surprise, and he didn't kill them, surprise. And so the family, like, they're just estranged, and so that Kevin McAllister gives him some sage, like, tiny little kid advice about how
in his 2 days worth of experience being by himself,
yeah about how he shouldn't be afraid because he was able to go downstairs.
I used to be afraid of the basement and now I'm not anymore, so you should mend with your son.
Yeah It is good advice. Kevin McAllister, relationship counselor.
He's a very strange kid. Like, it's been 2 days, and I guess the reason he doesn't call the cops is just like, well, what am I going to say? I wished my family away, and now I have to deal with the consequences until he can eventually go ask Santa for his family back.
Yeah.
It's like the things that he chooses to be realistic about and the things that he chooses to just believe in magical fairy tales are just hilarious.
Yeah.
But I guess he's eight, so, you know, looking for logical consistency is not really something you should do.
Can we talk about that Santa scene for a second? If I was that Santa, I would have been like, this is a red flag.
Also, another thing in 2014, like, giving some random kid three Tic Tacs and saying, there you go, kid. You eat those and have a good night. Like, maybe don't give things like little unwrapped candy to kids you meet on the street, but sure.
Yeah, well, also, he'd be sued for giving something to a potentially gluten intolerant child. So, anyway.
Oh, my God.
You know what happened. if this movie took place in Santa Monica in 2014, my God. No, but anyway, the whole scene unfolds, and he's going to go back, and he's going to defend the house by himself, which is ludicrous. But this is fine, because I love the part where he actually defends the house by himself, because it's comically entertaining for the slapstick value alone.
Of all the things that, like, I remember when I was young, I loved, like, he had that diagram of his house. And I'm pretty certain that I probably made, like, a crayon diagram of my house and how I would defend it as well. But, like, he gets home and it's already nighttime. It's like, why did you wait so long? And then he unrolls this big, long diagram. Like, where did that come from? We didn't see you building this. And he puts together every single one of those booby traps over the span of, like, 45 minutes.
But it gets dark early in the winter, Dan.
I don't have any firsthand experience with that, so it's odd to me.
You have firsthand experience with darkness?
With winter?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it gets dark at like 5:45 here, but it's not really winter.
Okay. So anyway, I'm fine with this conceit of this movie at this point, because I just want to watch these burglars get painfully tortured, which is what happens. And I'm glad for it. The scenes that unfold are wonderful. It is, you know, of course, too perfectly timed, and they don't see things exactly how the audience sees things, so it's funny to us, but to them it seems illogical. So the movie does not stand up to scrutiny, but that's not really the point of this, so chillax, people. And so the chillax listeners, the whole thing of them coming inside, and they have to go around back, and one of them goes around front. First of all, splitting up the party, always a bad idea. It's a rule of D&D. And then, so the Marv goes down the stairs, and by goes down, I mean completely falls down the stairs. Oh, I'm sorry. First, they go to the door, and they get shot in the balls by the BB gun, and Marv gets shot in the face by the BB gun, and then Marv goes down the stairs by sliding down the iced stairs, and Harry goes down the upstairs by sliding down the upwards stairs, and then they finally...
The stairs froze over really quick, too, didn't they?
Oh, they did, yes. Jason commented on that. And they do this whole little thing. Little, you know, maneuver, and I have to applaud them for the physical acting that they did for this, because it was quite convincing, and they finally get to their locations. Harry's going to touch the doorknob, and Mario is going to break into the basement. Big mistake for Harry, because it turns out that there was a charcoal warmer thing on the other side of the door handle. So he is forever marked by the M in the McAllister family doorknob, branded, if you were, and it also falls all the way back down the iced stairs. And Harry breaks into an unlocked door, and then quickly realizes that the light bulb is not a light bulb, it is but an iron. And that the stairs that are covered in tar are not just covered in tar, but also covered in roof shingles with nails sticking out.
There was only one nail, though, wasn't there?
Yes, it was remarkable how perfectly he landed on that.
And for the fact that, like, he's pulling his shoes and socks off, you think he might be looking down on occasion to the fact that his stuff is stuck to... whatever. It was a nice forced perspective shot of the nail pretending to go into his foot and being very painful.
Yes. Marv is not the brightest bulb in the laundry chute. And so, you know, he leaves this scene, and he goes back up the stairs, and he's going to find some other way in. And of course, he finds the window that's open, and opens the window, and does not look down. Which, if I had no shoes, and they were covered, and my feet were covered in tar, and I had a giant wound from a nail, the first thing I would do is look at the floor. But of course, we were treated to a view of just a bunch of glass Christmas ornaments, and he steps on all of them. And that's nice for him. Good job.
Unless he had been the one who had the blowtorch that hit him in the face, or the top of the head, I should say. And then I would be looking up and then maybe disregard the floor a little bit. But yeah, he's just looking at the Christmas tree that's like 2 feet away and kind of ignoring all of that stuff that should be really close to him and obvious.
I think the lesson here is to look around and see the space that you're in and use that information to guide where you put your hands and feet and head.
Now, do you think it would hurt more or less these days and age when it's when you're stepping on plastic ornaments that aren't necessarily going to break? They're just going to be very, very painful.
I don't know. I mean, a lot of families are probably going to have those antique glass ornaments because they're vintage. Think of all the hipster families now.
Yeah, probably. Also, these are ornaments that have probably been passed down for generation at the McAllister family.
Yeah, yeah. Sentimental value permanently destroyed. But they get in. They both manage once you know, Harry gets past the flamethrower to the head, and Mark.
By the way, where did he get that? Why was that in the house?
For emergency mannequin bonfires? I have no idea.
They're relighting their giant furnace or something?
I have no idea. The things that are inside of this house in the house in the second movie make no sense to me. But they use this to their advantage. And so this all unfolds, this situation, this scenario, which is fantastic, because then they're inside, and then Kevin McAllister's like, come up here and get me. And then in unison, they walk into a well-lit room covered in micro machines without looking at the floor, and they all fall on the ground.
I have so many micro machines.
Yeah, I know. But see, I didn't have the car micro machines. I had the Star Trek micro machines, and my brother had the Star Wars micro machines. I had the Borg cube, and I had a. I still have my Bird of Prey. But it always kind of bugged me. The Bird of Prey wings are kind of bent because the plastic molding was not like perfect on it. Anyway, so they step on these and they fall on the ground, and Kevin McAllister is like, ah, oh, come up and get me. And they're just like, ah, oh, Rastafratton, Double Breton, and then, you know, all the Yosemite Sam stuff. And they go up the stairs, you know, which is kind of funny for Joe Pesci, because if you've seen any other Joe Pesci movie, like, you know, Goodfellas or something like this, to see the G-rated version of Joe Pesci dialogue is amusing.
Yeah, you're surprised that, like, the moment he gets line of sight of Macaulay Culkin, he just doesn't pull out a gun and shoot him.
Yeah, I know.
Which, he did have a gun in his cop uniform, unless it was fake, so...
Well, it was fake, I think, potentially, because he didn't use it. But in the second movie, they did have a gun, and they were going to use it, but let's talk about that later. Next year. And so the scene here with this, they have the they're gonna go up the stairs and get him. Ah, we're gonna get you, kid. And then paint cans to the face, which is great. And I, you know, it's hard to see a giant can coming at your face, but they yeah. So poor guys. And so they get knocked on their butts for that, and then they go back up the stairs. And Kevin has all of his other little gimmicks and pranks and leaves to go to the treehouse on his little bike handlebars on the rope thing.
the very loose zip line.
Yes. Yeah. And then for some reason, Harry talks Marv into going on the rope. And he says, this will be the fastest, easiest way there. Like, he just wants us to go back through this dumb house and get caught in all of the other traps. If I were them, I would just go out the way I came in, because that would make the most sense, since all of those traps would have been tripped already, rather than go on a line that is three stories above the ground, where you don't control either end of the line, which comes into play in, like, mere moments when Kevin McAllister cuts the line and they fall to the ground.
So much about that is just 100% physically accurate.
Mm-hmm.
The droopy rope, the fact that they were so far out in the line, they would have hit the ground instead of the brick wall.
What I especially love about it is when it's cut, you see them fall downwards, but in the next scene, they're falling sideways.
Yep.
So you can watch the camera cut, kids, at home, and enjoy it.
I also like, I guess I didn't notice it back in 1990, but the handlebars that Kevin is holding on to as he cruises across, you can very clearly see the wires that are holding him up attached to his vest are running down the sleeves of his sweater.
Movie magic.
Nowadays they would just do it in CG, and that takes all the fun out of it, right? Because it, you know, you don't see the magic in the movie.
Yeah, it would just be a CG Kevin McAllister on a line. But anyway, they go through all of this, and then Kevin runs over to the other neighbor's house where he'd called the cops to go over to.
Where he wades through a waist deep flooded basement in the middle of winter, which probably be pretty damn cold, and he'd probably get some hypothermia. But okay, sure, we'll just move past that.
Yeah, well, I mean, this doesn't make any sense. I mean, if you're going to call the cops, why didn't you call the cops where you lived? If you're going to call the cops at this other place, why didn't you run over there the first thing? This does not make any sense.
He doesn't want the cops on his property.
Yeah, because he doesn't want to get busted for being home alone. But at the same time, it's...
Well, they would arrest him for magic... murdering his family by making them disappear. I don't know.
The American Dental Association would arrest him for stealing a toothbrush, but
right, he's probably still too afraid to call the cops because they would arrest him for his inadvertently stolen toothbrush.
Yeah, so anyway, they go over to the other house and they're like, oh, well, we'll outsmart him by going up the stairs rather than following him. And I'm like, finally, that seems like an actually like a good idea. And they go in and, of course, outsmart him, put him up on the thing, and then the old man comes in with the snow shovel and whacks them both on the head, which seems slightly out of character for such a passive character in the movie, but he uncooks Kevin, and he's like, oh, come on, I'm going to take you home. And then he takes Kevin home to Kevin's house, which is deserted, and leaves Kevin by himself, which seems 100% irresponsible at this point. And then I guess he goes back to his house, and then they both just watch the street to see when the police show up to take away the robbers. I don't know.
Well, he's got to go get his house ready for his son who's coming tomorrow, but I want to see the shot that got cut out where he's like salting the sidewalk, and then he sees like some people fall out of the tree house or off, you know, the rope whacks against the house, and then he just watches Kevin and these robbers run across the street to the other house, and he's just kind of standing there with his shovel like, that doesn't look good, maybe I should go see what that's all about. And then he just sneaks in the door and whacks him in the face with his shovel.
I bet they shot it, but then they took it out because, oh, it won't be enough of a surprise. But in this,
he was probably just standing there and then like hid behind a bush like partially or something, and he's like, I guess these guys didn't really think about the fact that I'm still here and I live next door.
Yeah, whatever. So the whole thing was kind of silly and contrived, but a lot of fun, I would say, in my opinion, still to this day. But I don't know how much of that is my nostalgia for my original viewings of this film.
No, it's still fun, but there are a few other things that like I forgot about. Like the... all this time that they're intercutting with the mom in the van with Gus, the Polka King or whatever. And she's talking about like, oh, I'm such a bad mom and this and that. And then John Candy proceeds to go on this rant, like just bashing the living hell out of all of the guys in the van. Like, oh, he's such a bad dad. He's never even met his kids. And let's hope nobody ever looks into his past. It's like, what? Why are you saying these awful things about your bandmates?
Polka's rough, man.
the rough streets of Polka.
Yeah, hard drugs and stuff. I mean, you're lucky he didn't go into any of that detail. We get the lovely scene of Catherine O'Hara finally, against all odds, making it home, and she's finally with her kid, and she's just happy to see him. No judgment, just happy to see you. And then the family saunters in, because they waited to just take that flight that she couldn't wait for. And so then it's just one big happy family reunion, until Buzz goes upstairs to his room.
Yeah. It is pretty funny that 90% of the family just like, they had a quick trip to Paris and it was cut short, unfortunately, by one of their children. But, you know, they took their nice first class trip on the way back home, and they probably got a good nap on the way back. And then, oh, hey, it's Christmas time back home and we got the kid and he's not dead. So All's well, evidently.
Yeah, yeah, white privilege. But I don't know. But it does seem like one of those things. Like, my family wouldn't have done that. I mean, if I was, you know, abandoned by some clerical error in some location, like, I can't imagine them, like, coming back and spending thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to arrive and ruin potentially their vacation. But it worked out for this family. And
are you saying your family would have just left you there?
Well, I don't know if they would have just left me, but maybe they would have just arranged for me to go. But I think that probably would have had more to do with me not being a total jerk and, like, actually fessing up to the fact that I was at home by myself rather than skirting all responsibility for that and just sort of hanging out by myself and eating nothing but dairy products.
Yeah, they did.
3 days.
The family did kind of stop trying to call their actual house pretty quickly, didn't they?
Yeah, but, you know, phone calls are expensive back then.
Well, you know, they're rude people. I'm sure they could just use Uncle Rob's phone until Kevin picks up,
I guess. But so, you know, one of the big characters in this movie, like I mentioned, was, of course, John Williams' score, which runs throughout. And there's even, like, a little action cue, like 1990s, like, you know, gonna get it done action cue when he runs out of the church to set up for his thing. There's a lot going on here. And I quite like that. And I think it provides a lot of character and you know, elevates this, I think, from what otherwise might be sort of rudimentary, silly stuff you'd hear nowadays in films. And to speak of modern films, this film's edited by Raja Gosnell, who was the director of Beverly Hills Chihuahua 1 and 2, and also Smurfs and Smurfs 2, and Never Been Kissed, and Big Mama's House, and Scooby-Doo. And he directed Home Alone 3, which is god-awful. Burn that movie.
That's that one has a different kid in it, right?
Yeah. That was the one that sank the franchise.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It is worth noting that the movie was nominated for 2 Academy Awards, one of which being your John Williams score.
Yeah. Well, it was good. It was good stuff. It's so good they reused it in the second one.
Well, you got to have the theme song, just like, you know, Jurassic Park.
Dun 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 dun.
Oh my god.
Dun 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 dun.
Oh, okay, so here's what's going to happen. You and me, we need to write Home Alone 4 rebooted with Chris Pratt.
Chris Pratt is Home Alone, and Bryce Dallas Howard is the mom frantically trying to find him.
She's a redhead already, so it's perfect.
Oh, God, this is so stupid. And the Velociraptors are trying to break into the house.
They got their little claw hand and they can open the front door, but oh, he put the little hot thing on there, so he burns his talon.
And then the Velociraptors all step on the micro machines.
They're slipping and slipping. No, they even did that in Jurassic Park. They did the frozen floor thing when he runs into the freezer.
Yeah, but with micro machines. The Christmas tree, have a happy holiday. Everyone dancing merrily in the new old-fashioned way.
Holiday. Everyone.